back together again. You and I chatting it up, wrapping up a very busy week with a busy Friday show, Halloween, October the 31st, 2025. On Connecticut Today, we have the latest developments on the possible loss of SNAP food benefits for thousands of state recipients. Former Bridgeport Democratic State Rep Chris Caruso dropped by with his weekly wrap-up. Quinnipiac University Journalism Department Chair and Professor Ben Bogardus talked about some big changes being announced at CBS News by its new leader. While we welcomed a buddy of mine, Hartford Current sports writer Dom Amore, co-author of More Than a Game, How the UConn Basketball Dynasty Was Built on a Culture of Caring. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Connecticut U.S. Senator Chris Murphy. Great to see you, Senator. How are you? Listen, Chris Murphy has, 12 million bucks in the bank. He's got a new girlfriend. He's growing a beard. And he's one of these guys who does not want to reopen the government and feed people on the weekend. So, folks, sit back in your recliners at home. Sit back in your rockers. And I'm not making this up. Within hours of people not being able to eat, here's what we got from Chris Murphy earlier today. And by the way, I'm only going to play a fraction of this, because if I played any more, your heads would explode. So, Senator Murphy, you're first up, sir. You have the floor.
Republicans think the American people are dumb. They aren't dumb. They know who's to blame for the shutdown. Here's the latest poll. 53% of Americans say that Republicans and Trump is to blame. Only 37% say Democrats. What's interesting is that in those polls, obviously, Republicans tend to blame Democrats and Democrats tend to blame Republicans. So what's more interesting is looking at what independents say, what unaffiliated voters say. And there, it's even more extreme. 58% say Republicans are to blame. Democrats are blamed only by 21%, a 37% spread. Ooh. People know what's going on.
Yeah.
People see
the
fact that Republicans are boycotting Washington right now. The House of Representatives has been on an unplanned 6-week recess from Washington. They see
there's no reason
Republicans
for them to be
in the Senate
there.
Are refusing to negotiate with
Who's
Democrats.
Who's refusing?
The reason that they're refusing to negotiate, the reasons that Republicans are causing the shutdown is because they know what Democrats are asking for.
Well,
we're
yeah.
asking for premiums to not go up on families this fall. Republicans want those premiums to go up because they're using the money that they're
saving come up for air.
To finance their tax cut for billionaires.
Breathe.
They don't want to negotiate with Democrats because they know that we're going to ask for provisions in the budget that make it harder for Donald Trump to engage in his censorship campaign.
Oh, my
make
God.
It harder for him
censorship
to destroy
campaigns.
Democratic norms.
Here it comes.
They know they'd get in trouble with Donald
Here
Trump
it comes.
If they stood
Here it comes.
In the way
listen,
of
listen.
His campaign to try to destroy our democracy.
Destroy our democracy. There it is. All right. How about a round of applause for Senator Chris Murphy, ladies and gentlemen? Yes. Yes. Now, let's welcome on our game as we begin here a person who also serves in the U.S. Senate, who is not a Republican, who is of Mr. Murphy's party, granted he is in his first term here, a gentleman who, despite not having the gravitas and everything is of Chris Murphy, is a real blue-collar guy, working-class guy from Pennsylvania, and he is soldiering along. As he continues to recover in a sensory case, being able to speak and interpret text and read, how about a big hand for Pennsylvania Senator John Fetterman, ladies and gentlemen. Senator John Fetterman, Senator Fetterman, yes. Let's have a big hand for Connecticut Senator John Fetterman. Yes, 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 yes. Now, we heard Chris Murphy right now. Now, just to let you know, that Murphy pablum was a minute and 25 seconds. And he was giving us numbers, and he was showing us how erudite he was. Here in 23 seconds is far more sense than you heard from Chris Murphy in a minute and change. Here's 23 seconds. Of a recovering stroke victim having more sense than Chris Murphy.
As a Democrat, I am incredibly, I've been disappointed, and I refuse to have a political gamble that's going to put those kinds of food security for 42 million Americans at risk on this. Now, some people might be afraid of the extreme left, but I am not one. I am not one of those Dems.
How about that? A big hand for Pennsylvania Democratic Senator John Fetterman, who in about one quarter of the time and far less bullcrap basically said, look, I'm a Democrat. I know there are concerns here. I'm not going to be beaten into submission by the far left. He mentions it. He basically says, sitting, and by the way, that was from his appearance last night with Chris Cuomo on News Nation. That was making the rounds this morning. And, you know, and here's the juxtaposition, folks. Chris Murphy talking about the oligarchs and destroying democracy. And we got a minute. And by the way, that Chris Murphy thing was about 3 minutes. I spared you in the middle. Because if I played that whole Chris Murphy thing, Chris would have had a news story later on of people in Fairfield County jumping off buildings. So that's why I spared you the crazed ramblings of Chris Murphy. But having said that, again, in all seriousness, John Fetterman.
As a Democrat, I am incredibly, I've been disappointed, and I refuse to have a political gamble that's going to put those kinds of food security for 42 million Americans at risk on this. Now, some people might be afraid of the extreme left, but I am not one. I am not one of those Dems.
He's not afraid of the extreme left. And right there, Senator Fetterman tells you what's going on here. Chris Murphy and Rosa DeLauro and Jim Himes and everybody will give you the ba 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 ba, and John Fetterman. And you can hear a guy, God bless him, I've had strokes in my family. You can hear he's just about getting back up to speed on speaking and on really telling people what's going on here. And John Fetterman said, no, I'm not going to be intimidated by the left. So I hope in that we had our little game show today to open the show. So I ask you at 203-333-9422-333-WICC. Simple question here. Who should get most of the blame if or when SNAP food benefits are stopped on November 1st, which is tomorrow? Which is tomorrow? Chris Murphy is worried about polls and about using people's hunger to get a wedge in against Trump. And John Fetterman, an old line Democrat from Pennsylvania, says, no, I'm not going to be bullied by the lefties in my party. Who do you believe?
They don't want to negotiate with Democrats because they know that we're going to ask for provisions in the budget that make it harder for Donald Trump to engage in his censorship campaign, make it harder for him to destroy democratic norms. And they know they'd get in trouble with Donald Trump if they stood in the way of his campaign to try to destroy our democracy.
Yes, there's a battle for the soul of the Democratic Party. That was Chris Murphy.
Some people might be afraid of the extreme left, but I am not one. I am not one of those Dems.
And that's Democratic Pennsylvania U.S. Senator John Fetterman. So who do you like? Who do you believe here? 203-333-9422-333-WICC. So there you have it. Listen, I'm a registered Republican. You know that. And frankly, I'm sitting and watching a clown car right now. I am. The once great Democratic Party, the party of JFK and FDR and Harry Truman and LBJ and Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. And you've got a fighting in here between party members. This is great. Chris Murphy on his presidential campaign crusade, which got him zero in New Hampshire. But again, New Hampshire's New Hampshire, you know, whatever. They want Pete Buttigieg, fine. And here you have, and I hesitate. I say this only because it is a wonderful juxtaposition that you have a guy who was fighting through some level of physical difficulty here, and John Fetterman, who was having trouble, as you could hear, speaking smoothly and auditory perception processing and everything because of his the stroke he had months ago. And he still makes more sense than numerous people in his party, including Chris Murphy and including Richard Blumenthal. Now, who knows what's going to happen this weekend? We have an update coming up in less than 10 minutes at the bottom of the hour on at 31 after. Apparently, there's been some sort of a court ruling in this snap situation, but we will keep an eye on that. So, listen, let's assume for the time being. Now, we don't know what the courts are going to say on this, but if and or when any SNAP food benefit subsidies are stopped, maybe this weekend, maybe in 2 or 3 weeks, whose fault is it? See, at base level here, I understand what Senator Murphy is saying. I get it. I understand it. I'm not disagreeing with him on that. If he wants to negotiate and go to war, as it would be, legislatively with the Trump White House over the Affordable Care Act, tax subsidies and all that, absolutely, go for it. Nothing wrong there. But again, you juxtapose that with Senator Fetterman, who said, hey, no, but we don't do that with a program. You don't hold food over people's heads. I don't know why Congresswoman DeLauro, why Jim Himes, why Johanna Hayes, why John Larson, why Joe Courtney, why Richard Blumenthal, and why Chris Murphy don't get that. Well, you know, Trump and the Republicans, they may be doing the same thing with health care. Okay, I get that. But people have to eat. Well, you know, Trump, and I don't care, Trump. People have to eat. It's easy for all these House and Senate members like our delegation to F around with this when they're making $180,000 a year. They're not worried about it. Of course they're not. Oh, but we care about the American people. You care so much about the American people that you're going to F around with their food. Well, you know, Trump, I don't care, Trump. Just stop that for a minute. Consider that you're going to F around with their food. Well, that's being... Now, listen, I know you need leverage. I understand how leverage works. Yeah, we all do. Democrats, Republicans, we get it. We understand it. Whether it's your town council or your board of ed or your county supervisors, that's great. Bitch and moan and argue with everybody all you want. Go on all the Sunday shows. You don't play around with people's food. Yes, it is that time of the week where we put on our capes, we get in the Batmobile, and we drive around the great Gotham of Bridgeport, the great state of Connecticut, and look for stew nods, cavones, real chooches. Chris Caruso and I. Chris, Mr. Caruso, good afternoon. How are you?
Happy Halloween, Paul.
Yes, yes. What? How do the chooches, Chris, draw? What do they dress as? What's a chooch costume?
Some of them don't have to dress up. You could identify them once they open their mouth. You know that?
Oh, as my father used to say in the store, oh, here comes that one. That whenever we heard that one, Chris, we knew. We knew it was time.
You know, Paul, there's something going around the internet on Facebook.
Yeah.
Gabagool.
Yeah.
No candy, gabagool. They get the kids get gabagool.
Yeah, I saw that. Can you imagine some trick or treat and dropping a couple of slices of gabagool in there? Oh my God! Hey, and if you're a high class house, it's prosciutto. Yeah. Never mind gabagool. Yeah, give him some prosciutto. All right, Chris. A lot of stuff to talk about this week. Let's start with and this fascinated me. The Board of Education. There is this outside firm, I guess the state's kicking in some of the money. It's like $250,000. You and I have talked about this. Chris, we have seen what's happened over the years when different people, different consultants come in and tell people in Bridgeport to do stuff a better way, in a different way. Are you hopeful for this consultant or not?
I am, Paul. I'm not so hopeful for some in Bridgeport that are criticizing it. Let's face it, there's been problems with the Board of Education. No, you know, you could sit here and say there hasn't been, there has been. And that's what led to the state oversight of the Bridgeport education system. Now, the truth is, the state hasn't been, you know, providing the necessary funding as they do other communities throughout the state, and cities in particular have been underfunded. But in fairness, the city has underfunded dollars, too, for the Bridgeport education system. So there's a state formula, and the city has to reach a certain threshold that the city hasn't been doing. So, you know, the state oversight came in. They did a forensic audit. They came up with 34 or 39 recommendations, and now they're hiring, the state is hiring, not the city, the state is hiring a consulting group to come in, work through those recommendations, and to frankly right the ship. And I can't argue with them, because the state shouldn't put more money into a system where there was problems. That, you know, everyone would sit there and say, oh, that's not the way to go, you should correct the problems. Well, that's what they're trying to do. And I think people have to be supportive of it, because I think down the road, once the problems are corrected, you'll see the additional funding come in to the system. And, you know, over the years, Bridgeport has received state funding just as every municipality. But, you know, the question has been how the money has been spent. You know, our educators don't receive the proper funding, frankly, as far as salaries. We have vacancies in those in positions of education. But so far, because of the state oversight, I've seen some positive things happening. So I would say everyone hold their breath a little bit, you know, welcome this firm to come in, you know, work with them to uncover the problems and correct them with recommendations, you know, right the ship. And then we'll work toward the funding. But there's steps that have to be followed first, and I think that's important.
Absolutely. Number two, Chris, how are we coming with those Bridgeport Charter revision changes? What's the update on those?
Well, they're going to be up on this coming election Tuesday, and you know, people have an opportunity to vote for their city council, but also the Board of Education position.
Yeah.
And there'll be two questions. Also, sheriffs, I think, are up for election, too, on Tuesday. And there'll be two questions. The first question talks about the overall charter and the changes that are being recommended, for example, civil service, city council powers, ethics commission.
Yeah.
I would support it. The only thing, caveat that I would raise, that if it is passed, the ethics commission, the public, and the commissioners need to be vigilant over the role of the city attorney's office in the deliberations. Because, as I've said before, the city attorney represents every aspect of city government. And so there's a question of potential conflict. Now, the city attorney has to declare if there's a conflict, but the public and the commissioners need to be vigilant on that, because it's important, not only from the optic. If there is a conflict, you know, how it looks, the perception sometimes is worse than the reality and the reality of it. So it's going to be up to the public. But I have to say the ethics commission that's proposed is very strong.
Good.
It will be the first commission in the state of Connecticut for ethics where you'll have an office of ethics with a director.
Nice.
You'll have the ability for the ethics commission to levy penalties for illegal actions of the code of ethics. So there's a lot of safeguards that I think are positive, and I'd hate to see that thrown out. But at the same time, the public can't be spectators. They've got to be involved.
Yeah.
The commissioners have to be to make sure it runs the way it should be. So I would go with that one. There's a second question, which would abolish the positions of town clerk and city clerk and make them appointed. I oppose that one.
Yeah, me too.
And the reason I oppose it, as you chip away from elected positions, you slowly start chipping away at democracy and the voters' rights to participate in elections. So for question number one, I support that. Question number two, I don't support it. So for what that's worth, you can go online and find out more information. But I think overall it's good for question one. We're making changes. Question two, let's keep the city clerk and town clerk position in place.
Absolutely. And Chris, in about the minute we have left, that kind of weaves into finally, again, those city and town clerks are inextricably linked to, of course, absentee ballots here. And we see another level of investigation into Mr. Castillo here, who's up for re-election. So, again, those two questions, Chris, I'm like, you know, these are tied in here. Let's not, you know, we already have these investigations going. And I know the investigations, I guess, Chris, are far from over.
Well, no, that's right. And, you know, with Mr. Castillo, they found out that he never, I guess he was employee for the city of Bridgeport under the HUD program.
Yeah.
You know, housing. And he never turned in his badge when he left that position.
Jeez.
So now the feds are involved looking at this. Of a federal violation of law. So, you know, it's getting deeper and deeper, not only from state statutes that have been potentially violated, you know, their allegations, they have to be proven in court, but also now federal law that's been violated too, or allegedly.
Yeah.
So in both cases, it's only getting deeper and deeper, and it's really sad for the city of Bridgeport. But, you know, everything happens for a reason.
Yeah.
We've come to a point now, we've got a clean house. As I said, people that are in violation need to be punished. It's just exactly what you've seen with Diamantis, you know, the deputy director.
Yep.
And happy to say, you know, that's the law I put in about revocation of
pensions.
Good
for you. Yep.
And that will come now where his pension could be revoked. And that's under the law. The attorney general of the state, you know, would enter a pleading into the courts to have the pension removed. But I've always believed that if you're a public servant, an employee of the city, the state, what have you, and you rip off the taxpayers, you defraud the government and the people, you've got to pay. It's just, you know, for years, people would do this and they keep all their pension. Well, you know, hey, there's a consequence. My mother always told me there was a consequence. And I was more afraid of my mother than I was the cops, to be honest with you.
Great stuff.
There's always a consequence.
You know? You're right, Chris. There has to be or nobody changes. Chris Caruso. Chris, thank you. Yeah. Great stuff as always.
Okay.
Have a great weekend, and we'll check back
you
with
too.
You next week. Thank you, Chris.
Okay.
Appreciate it. When our parents were growing up, maybe even grandparents, back to the days of, you know, radio and radio news as we have here on WICC twice an hour during the afternoons, top of the hour, 24/7, 365. CBS News was considered what they used to call the Tiffany Network. It was the gold standard of first radio news, then television news. I have books about, you know, Ed Murrow and his cohorts and Eric Severide and Douglas Edwards and Richard C. Hodlett, and, you know, news geeks will remember those. But there's been a lot of unrest you're reading now at CBS News, especially in the local papers, particularly the New York Times and New York Post. They have a new boss there. And even how she got the job is interesting. And a lot of hardcore CBS viewers in the tri-state area here to talk about that, a return visit from Quinnipiac University Journalism Department Chair and Professor Ben Bogardus, who was going to clue us in on this. Ben has had some experience at the network level. Hey, Ben, it's Paul once again. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Well, first of all, explain to my listeners, Ben, who Barry Weiss is. Now, I know who she is. You know who she is. But how did this essentially print journalist turn blogger, turned a favorite of people on both sides of the aisle, how did she rise to the top now of CBS News?
Yeah, it's a sort of a fascinating example of how the online world intersects with the TV world and social media, because, you know, she was a opinion writer on their editorial board at the New York Times. It was times during 4 years ago when things were, you know, Black Lives Matter protests were going on, and there was a lot of, you know, tensions in the New York Times newsroom about some of the things that they were printing in the editorial page. And it got to the point where she quit. She thought that the sort of more moderate views, the more conservative views, were being censored. And she considers herself more of a liberal, but she says that she wanted a more variety, wide opinions in the New York Times editorial page. And so when she left, she started a sort of a Substack site, subscription-based website, the Free Press, where she would, you know, bring in writers of, you know, differing opinions. And that became very popular, especially among conservatives who saw her as sort of someone who could sort of reach out to them and give them credibility, you know, give them a sense that they are being listened to by the mainstream press. And then when she became the site that bought CBS, Skydance, decided to buy her site and buy CBS and combine the two, and they decided to make her the sort of the boss in the newsrooms, give her marching orders to sort of turn the network around in the sense of, you know, many people complained it had been too liberal or been too elitist. So she was brought in to sort of change it, make it something that it has a wider appeal to a larger demographic.
You know, Ben, it's one thing to have a really successful blog, and the free press is great, and I used to read it a lot. Now it's behind a paywall, so, you know. But having said that, I like the variety of writers she had. But, Ben, that's a big leap from going from even having your very successful blog bought to running CBS News. And and that includes the CBS Evening News, the morning news program, 60 Minutes. And I can understand, and you could see and hear these leaks out of the newsroom where people think literally like a bomb is going off there, you know?
Exactly. And this is, to me, it's the mentality of, you know, Silicon Valley, the, you know, move fast and break things, you know, bring someone in who's totally from the outside, whose mission is to just disrupt every single aspect of what they do. So the new owner is just saying that, you know, CBS has just become too complacent. It's too slow. It's too old. So we want someone to come in from the outside who does not have a TV background, but instead has this mission to shake up the newsroom. And she's going department by department, you know, telling them basically, you know, what you have been doing is not going to fly anymore. We need to change directions. We need to do it now.
What is the reason, though, Ben, and I haven't seen the nightly numbers recently, CBS, ABC with David Muir, and the NBC Nightly News. Now, I know a lot of people who might not be the news junkies you and I are, say, well, everybody watches cable news now. Nobody watches the broadcast and nightly news. And I tell them, well, no, they still, Ben, on any given night, ABC, CBS, NBC, and even, I guess we could say PBS as well, even the even the over-the-air networks traditionally, they still get millions of viewers every night.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, there is, still is an audience. I mean, they would not be on the air if they didn't make money doing it. You know, they aren't doing it as a charity. So this is really, you know, CBS, the new owners, saying, yeah, that's worked, but we don't think that the ratings are suddenly going to improve if we keep doing what we're doing. CBS, they changed their format earlier this year. They brought in two new anchors, and that hasn't been the success that they hoped it's been. You know, ratings have, you know, still been sluggish. CBS is, you know, generally in second or third place in the ratings. So they're really looking for something new, a new direction. And, you know, just bringing in the same old, according to the new owners, you know, that's just not going to cut it anymore.
Yeah, and Ben, you know, it is really all packaging, isn't it? Because I know different networks have investigative units and they do enterprise pieces. But, you know, one of the first things my J teachers up at BU told us, and I still tell young kids today when I'm invited to speak, hey, the newscast, the networks, you don't create news. You report it. So outside of, you know, an investigative unit or an I-team sort of thing, you've got three or four networks basically figuring out how do we present this differently, and I guess that's Barry Weiss's task now, having not been from broadcasting. How do I view this and package this to make us do better?
Exactly, and she's also, the reason she was brought in is because she could speak to a more conservative audience that CBS has really struggled with basically forever. So I think they're hoping that she, when she's looking at all of the different products they put out, the different ways they produce their shows, there's been stories that she went to 60 Minutes and she basically told them, you're doing too many soft features. I want more hard investigative stories. Okay. So she is really going, you know, department by department, apparently, and, you know, looking at how they tell the news and saying, how can we do this better, and how can we reach the audience, which has traditionally been alienated by some of our coverage.
Yeah, and finally, Ben, you made me laugh because they've kind of, even when Walter Cronkite was considered America's newsman, you know, you look back at old sitcoms like, you know, All in the Family, and you had Archie complaining about, you know, how Walter Cronkite was some sort of pinko lefty. So, you know, it's kind of always been there, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And I think that's why, you know, the new owners, you know, Skydance, when they came in, they particularly picked CBS because they thought they had a lot to work with there and they could make, you know, big changes and hopefully get big returns on that. Obviously, that's still to be seen, but I think they chose CBS for a reason.
All right. We shall see. Great stuff. Quinnipiac University Journalism Department Chair, Professor Ben Bogardus. Hey, Ben, good to have you on. We'll chat down the road as this whole thing develops. Thank you, sir.
Absolutely. You're welcome.
All right. Thanks. So there you go. Yeah, we're back at it right here. Coming down the home stretch, another edition of Connecticut Today at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. All right. We've talked just about everything to death, all the rotten news all through the week, all the tense stuff. Let's once again have some fun. We'll do my Friday author spotlight and a local guy. Love doing that. I've known this guy for several decades, used to share a newspaper newsroom with him. We've kept in touch over the years. He's gone on to become a great sports writer, covered the New York Yankees for years, wrote a previous book on the Yankees. His new book, More Than a Game, How the UConn Basketball Dynasty Was Built on a Culture of Caring, along with Jim Calhoun, written by my buddy Dominic Amore. Dom Amore, Dom, how are you, buddy? Good to have you on. How you been?
Great, Paul. How's it going?
Not too bad, Dom. Thanks for stopping by. What was your epiphany on this? At what moment, if there was a specific moment, Dom, did you say, hey, I think this would be a good idea to get together with Coach Calhoun on this, and what is the premise of the book? How's it structured?
Yeah, well, Coach approached me. He had an idea that he wanted to do another book. You know, he wrote his autobiography in 1999, and he wrote a book on leadership a few years after that, and it's been a lot of water under the bridge since those books. So he wanted to do another one, and someone had sent him a book called The Wax Pack, which was a baseball book. A guy, the author, got a random pack of 1980s baseball cards, opened it up, and traveled the country to track down each of the 15 players.
Wow.
In the pack and what they were doing.
Wow.
And Jim just loved the idea. And he thought we could turn that upside down and maybe on its side a little bit and do a book where we examined his relationships with 10 or 12 or 15 players and other people in his life. And, you know, he wanted to do not just the usual guys that you would expect to read about, the Ray Allens, the Kemba Walkers, the Rip Hamiltons, the Caron Butlers. We've done those. We did those in the book. But he also wanted to talk about some of the people that he felt he had helped or who had helped him at Northeastern, at Dedham High School 50 plus years ago, mm-hmm. and then his last coaching stop at St. Joe's in West Hartford. So we decided on 15, 16 people, chapters on different people, and it's obviously Jim's own story is kind of woven through that, but for the most part, it's a book about his relationships with people and his determination through life to pay forward the things that were done for him by his coaches when he was really in need as a teenager and lost his father at age when he was 15. So he felt people had done things for him. He's always tried to pay that forward, and this is his book about those stories.
Yeah, and it's interesting that he wanted to go back to his high school days and then the days, Dom, at Northeastern. I went to BU, so of course both schools are pretty much down the street from each other, and I was doing BU basketball on the student radio station when Jim was at Northeastern and a guy named Rick Pitino was at BU, and I'm glad you did this because there are a lot of people, I think, Dom, maybe you agree or disagree with me, who don't know enough about Jim's effect on that program and the embryonic days of the great coach Calhoun, because, man, those Northeastern BU games were something. I still remember them, how great they were, and looking at Calhoun and just going, wow.
Yeah, you'll like then the chapter on Dr. Keith Motley, who was one of his players.
Yeah.
Early players at Northeastern and some of the others, other players that were on those teams, and how he kind of changed the program from what he inherited. Remember, they were Division II at one point. Mm-hmm. They made the transition to D1 when he was there. But, you know, Dr. Keith Motley went on to coach at Northeastern, but more importantly, become the first African-American college president in that part of the of Massachusetts. He became the president of UMass Boston. And those are kind of the kinds of things. A kid that he coached at Dedham High School went on to become a big deal at NASA, for instance.
Wow.
So those are the kind of stories that he really wanted to tell, in addition to, obviously, the basketball stories and the great basketball players that he coached.
So, Dom Amore, how did he do that? How did he weave that into pushing these players to be great on the floor and great in their professional lives if they didn't go on to play pro ball? Because, man, you look at coaches like Jim Calhoun, and you're like, back in the days when he was lighting up guys in practice, right, and on the court, you're like, wow, is there a vastly different off-the-court, inside the office, Jim Calhoun, that millions of fans haven't seen?
Well, of course, he has many sides to his personality, and people haven't seen all of them. But, you know, I think at the root of his relationships is that he believes that you can give people tough love, that you can coach people hard and you can push them hard and say almost anything to them as long as they know you care about them.
Yeah.
So as long as you know that it's coming from a place that has their best interest at heart. And as an example, you know, when he went to coach at St. Joe's, came out of retirement to do that, and he went looking for Division III basketball players. He wasn't going to be coaching NBA prospects.
Sure.
He knew that. But, he ran across one kid who was a good but not great basketball player, kind of a grinder. From Connecticut, named Sam Majak, and he really wanted to be a dentist. And the people, a lot of the people at his high schools and prep schools were telling him not to go into dentistry because it was very, very hard, and they didn't think that he would be able to keep up with the work, especially if he tried to play basketball. But Jim brought him into St. Joe's, and he said, "You want to be a dentist? You're going to be a dentist. We're going to find out what you need to do to do it, and then you're going to do it."
Wow.
And so he coached them as a student as well as a basketball player, and he was an important part of the team, but he was also studying constantly to get into dental school, and now he ended up getting in at UConn Dental School after he graduated from St. Joe's, and now he's ready to start his residency. So he's a dentist. He's going to be a dentist. So
that's
the kind of thing that Jim really savors as much as the guys that he turned into NBA basketball players.
The name of the book, More Than a Game, How the UConn Basketball Dynasty Was Built on a Culture of Caring, co-authored by Jim Calhoun and my guest for a few more minutes, Dominic Amore, currently, obviously, of the Hartford Courant, too, great sports writer for decades. Dom, you said that it was whittled down to, 15 players. What player relationship with Jim Calhoun do you think is really going to fascinate people without giving away too much of the details? We want them to buy or download the book, but what one or two players did Jim let you know of some oh-wow moments?
Well, the Caron Butler story, which Jim is often calls the great American success story, you know, is one. And, you know, Caron Butler was in reform school. He had been in solitary confinement for a while.
Wow.
As a teenager. And, you know, Jim went to go and see him in a community center in Racine, Wisconsin. And Jim talks about walking into the place and running into a policeman. And the policeman said, "I bet you're here to see the Butler kid." And Jim said, "Yeah." And the policeman said, "Well, you know, he's really not a bad kid. He just needs to get out of this situation. but he's really a good kid. That's why we haven't thrown him in jail or thrown him back in jail.
Yeah.
So Jim went in and to see him and all of that, and ultimately he figured, well, if a policeman feels that way about this kid, then he really must not be a bad kid, and he's worth trying to help and trying to pull out of this situation and save. And Jim facilitated him getting to a prep school and then obviously coming to UConn. And after 2 years, you know, Karan actually cried when Jim told him he needed to go to the NBA now. He thought he wanted to come back and play in college, didn't want to leave. And Jim really had to had to coax him to leave and take millions of dollars in the NBA. So those are the kind, and you know, Karan Butler, who worked at a Burger King in Racine, ended up owning the string of Burger Kings after a while.
What a great story.
That's one I think people will really like. But I think Jim's favorite part of the book, and I think people will really enjoy this because it's topical, was the student manager at UConn who, you know, came in as a freshman. Jim didn't pay him much attention or talk to him much, which is why he, until he started to see that, yeah, this kid's trustworthy, I could trust him. And Jim put his keys, his car keys in the kid's hand and said, drive my car to Madison Square Garden, follow the bus, park in the garage, and don't screw it up. And the kid who was from Massachusetts had no idea how to drive in New York, and the bus driver was like a whack job weaving in and out of traffic. And but the kid white-knuckled it all the way to the garden and parked the truck and gave Jim the keys, and he felt like the world weight of the world was off his shoulders, that Jim had trusted him with this task with his, you know, $50,000-$60,000 car.
Yeah.
And he got it there. And that kid, by the way, today is Mark Daigneault, the coach of the world champion Oklahoma City Thunder. Started as a student manager at UConn.
Jeez.
And he still believes that Jim, by pushing him and kind of making him scared to death, but also empowering him and entrusting him, was the thing that kind of helped get him on his way to where he's now a coach in the NBA and championship coach.
Wow. Folks, pick up the book. Great stories like that. The book is called More Than a Game, How the UConn Basketball Dynasty Was Built on a Culture of Caring, co-authored by, yes, Jim Calhoun and my friend Dominic Amore. Check out Dom's stuff weekly, daily sometimes, in the Hartford Current. Dom, thanks, my friend. Be good, and we shall chat down the road. Appreciate it.
Paul, great. Thanks for the opportunity. Thanks for having me, and best of luck to you.